Good morning and welcome to your WILP wake-up call. My name's Tana Hartman. I'm your host today, and our engineer is Dick Paddock. My co-host is Lucy Lewis, and our invited guest today had a delay and won't be with us, but we're going to be talking today about a little bit about the journey of reconciliation. I hope we'll be able to get our guest in here on another date. 42 years ago tomorrow, Dr. Martin Luther King spoke at Riverside Church in New York City, and that was a very historic speech. But before that, 20 years before that, the Congress of Racial Equality, which had been founded, by the way, in 1942 by a group of students in Chicago, they planned to send 8 white and 8 black men into the Deep South to test the Supreme Court ruling declaring segregation in interstate travel unconstitutional. Now, the Journey of Reconciliation was going to be a 2-week pilgrimage through Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Kentucky. And there were a lot of people, not surprisingly, that opposed it, including Thurgood Marshall, who thought that it would bring wholesale slaughter, I think is what he called it. But the journey began on April 9th, 1947. The people that were traveling included George Hauser, Bayard Rustin. Bayard Rustin later made a huge name for himself as the organizer who actually, I think, brought Martin Luther King to the concept of nonviolence. He's one of the people, because apparently before that, Dr. King had armed guards with him and had a gun in his house even. But after getting to know Bayard Rustin, who was a profound believer in Mahatma Gandhi and Henry David Thoreau's teachings, what I've read was that Dr. King decided that the nonviolence was, in fact, something that he believed himself, and he would support it. No? You don't?
I believe he still supported the right of armed self-defense.
Oh, did he?
I believe okay. that he definitely developed a Gandhian approach towards how he'd like to see strategically things going.
Right.
But I think he still supported the right of people to protect themselves and protected himself to the best he could, of course, until his assassination.
Yes,
but that's a minor point. I think the main thing that you're saying is in terms of his conceptualization of how civil rights were going to be challenged, that he really learned a tremendous amount from Gandhi's example of people standing up for what was right against the powers that be and being willing to take all kinds of abuse, even risking their lives and some giving their lives in the civil rights movement. So I think the main thing you're saying is something I would certainly concur with.
Certainly during the journey of reconciliation, it apparently startled some when, if they were hit, they did not retaliate, and that surprised a number of people. Dr. King's speech, since tomorrow's the anniversary, was a truly moving. That is the speech in which he confronts the United States government with its history of support for repressive regimes, of its crushing democratic movements around the globe, its support of materialism, capitalism, and racism, and violence. And it, I have read once or twice that, in fact, some people think that that was the speech that may have triggered his assassination, you know, that with a year later he was dead.
Well, I think at the time, a lot of other civil rights leaders really questioned his opposition to the war, that they felt that that was going too far and was outside the boundaries. And he really said the three were, that you mentioned, I think he called them the triplets of militarism, racism, and materialism, had to be confronted together and really challenged the mainstream leadership of the civil rights movement. But ended up, like you said, giving a historic speech that resonates today. I mean, you can read it and see it could be
moving.
Written about our current situation. It's a very comprehensive indictment of U.S. democracy and capitalism, and really calling for fundamental change. And that was terribly threatening to the status quo. And I think, as you put it so well, that many people think that that actually led to his death 1 year later to the day in Memphis.
Yeah. I'm going to read a brief section from his speech. I'd love to read the whole thing, but it's just too long. It said, "It should be incandescently clear that no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of men the world over. So it is that those of us who are yet determined that America will be are led down the path of protest and dissent, working for the health of our land." Now, this was in response to a quotation from Langston Hughes, the poet, who said, "Oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." Our guest has just arrived, probably caught in traffic. Welcome, Linda Marie.
Hello. I got stuck at a Main Street light.
Did you? Well, welcome. I'm glad you could make it. My guest today is Linda Marie Taurasi. She's a reporter for Free Speech Radio and for WCHL. Is
that
right?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Linda Marie has been working on a story about the journey of reconciliation. And she's here today to tell us about the story, which is about to break soon, right?
Yeah, it will air on Free Speech Radio News April 9th. I'm currently in the rounds of edits. And we had an issue with, this is a funny story, we had an issue with the sound quality on Ruby Sinreich.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who is co-communications director with the Fellowship of Reconciliation in Nyack, New York, but she lives in Chapel Hill. She's local, and you might know Ruby from orangepolitics.org. Mm-hmm. So the producer for Free Speech Radio News emailed me last week and said, "We can't use the audio," because she was on an internet phone. So it was kind of scratchy. Well, Ruby's in labor.
Oh, is she?
Yes. And the poor woman, she's been having labor pains. She's not in labor, but she's like pre-labor. And so I wrote to her and I was like, "I know you're in labor, but you know, can we redo some of your audio?" And she was like, "Yeah, come on over." And she was so gracious, but it was funny. I was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to be interviewing this woman and she's going to be giving birth."
Well, I hope all goes well for Ruby.
I do, yes. Too.
I knew her dad when he still lived here.
Yeah.
Joey Sinreich. We had mentioned that the journey of reconciliation started on April 9th of 1947, which
That's
was
correct.
Years before the Freedom Riders and what we think of as, you know, the real core of the civil rights movement.
Even heard of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
Before he became a famous civil rights leader.
But this, and at the end of February, February 28th, I think it was, the town of Chapel Hill put up a marker. Tell us about the marker. Oh, you know what? Excuse me, folks, but before we do that, I just want to say something. You're working for Free Speech Radio, and mm-hmm. I don't know how many folks know this, but I was just talking with Jerry Markatos, who's a wonderful resource and remembers lots of the history of what's gone on related to the media because of his involvement with Balance and Accuracy in Journalism, which has been around since 1991, I think. But Free Speech Radio was... I think the way Jerry described it was imagine an organic garden, you know, that has been taken over and, you know, paved over or turned into a, you know, a more commercial venture. But there are gardeners who are farmers who will take what was there and replant it. Places. Sorry, Jerry. I know I'm not doing justice.
And the analogy. I've lost the analogy.
All right. So I blew that one. All
That's
right,
okay.
So
I can explain it. The Pacifica Radio Network had some issues. I'm not really sure of the details, but they had some issues concerning their board members and how. I'm not really sure, but it basically what happened was that the reporters felt like their journalistic integrity was being compromised.
It was, because they were being, the network wanted more corporate.
Right, more corporate sponsorship, type. And right. I mean, it's still a community. It's the largest community syndicated news network, and they syndicate programs for community radio stations such as WCOM all over the country, about 90 affiliate radio stations. And so in 2000, these group of reporters decided to break away and form their own identity so that they could maintain their journalistic integrity. And they formed Free Speech Radio News.
And they've been doing it ever since.
Right.
And around the world, they keep people informed.
And I recently joined the team. You have to file a certain number of stories before you're officially a freelancer. So I have a few more stories to go, but this will be my second, and then I'm working on a third. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And my first was March 3rd, so it's really, really, really exciting for me. Yeah.
So your second story is about the journey of reconciliation. Tell us what.
Well, in Chapel Hill, downtown Chapel Hill, on February 28th, there was a state highway marker unveiled on the corner of Columbia and Franklin Street, and it was to commemorate what happened in Chapel Hill. 16 men, black and white, with the CORE, Congress for Racial Equality, and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, joined together to map out a system that would test the Irene Morgan Supreme Court ruling in 1946 that made segregated interstate highway travel illegal. And you might be familiar with Rosa Parks refusing to get off the bus, but actually it was Irene Morgan first.
Yeah.
I think she was in Virginia. She actually had a miscarriage, and she was on her way back home after just leaving the hospital, and she wasn't feeling well. And if you're a woman, I'm sure you can imagine what the emotional effects of a miscarriage will do. And so she got on the bus. She was sitting in the black section, and a white person got on. And the bus driver said she had to give up her seat, and she said no. And they manhandled her and arrested her. And Thurgood Marshall, who is former chief of the Supreme Court, before that, was working with the NAACP, and he took her case and tried it before the Supreme Court, and she won. And so George Hauser and Bayard Rustin, and if you don't know who they are, George Hauser was a white Methodist priest, who worked for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and Bayard Rustin was the man who mentored Martin Luther King for the Montgomery bus boycott. In 55, I believe, on nonviolence. Well, they were a group of conscientious objectioners. They actually, George Hauser was in prison for not wanting to fight in World War II, which is really interesting because you never think of activism in the 40s. And they got together and they decided that they were going to test this law by forming a bus trip and train trip from Washington, D.C. to Louisville, Kentucky, and it would loop back around.
And interestingly, Thurgood Marshall opposed it.
Yeah, he did. He did not want it to happen. He thought, you know,
it'd be slaughter.
Yeah, and we won the state. Let's just leave it at there for now. Right. That we'll have this new law. And they were like, no, it needs to be done. And George Hauser actually he described it as an act of education and direct action, which I thought that's his exact quote.
That's,
so. That's pretty interesting.
That is good. And tell us what happened in Chapel Hill. What made it so memorable?
Well, Chapel Hill was actually supposed to be kind of like a break in the journey. I mean, even in the 40s, Chapel Hill had a very progressive reputation, you know, with the university, and it was very liberal even back then, which I don't know. I can't imagine Chapel Hill being liberal in the 40s, but it was more liberal than it is now, according to that time. And so they decided they were going to visit a man named James Peck, who was a reverend with, I think it was University Methodist Church on Franklin Street. I'm not exactly sure about that, but he was a reverend, and they were going to visit him and just hang out and have a party and go to church the next day and then get back on this trip. Well, they stopped their journey. They went to visit him. He was having a great time. And the next day when they boarded the bus, they were told to... Well, the whole purpose of the journey was that they were defying Jim Crow. So they would have two black men sit in the front, kind of like protected by a white man. And then two white men in the back. you know, so in direct violation of Jim Crow. So they got on the bus on Columbia Street and Franklin Street, which at that time the police station was across the street from the bus station. And I think it's some restaurant now. And
oh yeah, it's that hotel.
No, it's further down. It's like near it's right on the corner of it's top of the hill. It's across the street from top of the hill.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So when I came here the bus station was down there
is
where
that
the Franklin
not right?
Hotel.
The bus station was at
Rosemary and Columbia
okay,
Street.
Okay, so you guys had you know, the old history. I know a later bus station.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it was where the shelter is now.
Where the shelter is now. That's where the bus station... No? Okay, we've got...
We're all confused.
Agree on where the old bus station
but the
was,
marker but is Columbia history. And Rosemary Street, and that's where the incident happened. And they were arrested. And not only were they arrested, but they were harassed by a group of white cab drivers who threatened them and...
Well, didn't one of them even strike?
Yeah, one of them did hit one of the Freedom Riders. And they went back to the Reverend's house, and he decided that he would drive them to Durham to continue on their journey.
I need to take just a minute and mention our sponsor,
okay.
Our underwriter, and we'll be right back. Internationalist Books at internationalistbooks.org. This is a wonderful community resource. They're at 405. Why can't I remember addresses?
It's Friday
405,
morning.
405, yeah, it's in sleepless night. 405 West Franklin Street. And you are being listening to the Wake Up Call, Wilf's Wake Up Call, and I'm Tana Hartman, your host. You can visit our website at trianglewilf.org. And one quick announcement, the Moncure strike is over. We'll have a report on that soon, but it's a big event. There was a celebration Wednesday night, and for those who've been following it, it's just quite an accomplishment. The other announcement I'd like to make is Amy Goodman is coming to town. She's coming to benefit WCOM and three other media groups, the People's Channel in Chapel Hill, WNCU at North Carolina Central University, and Balance and Accuracy in Journalism, the longstanding media advocacy organization that was started by Jerry Markatos. Amy is coming on April 8th. There'll be a catered reception at the Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship at 4907 Garrett Road in Durham. There'll be food by local food icon Vimala Rajendran. There was an article all about Vimala in this week's Independent, by the way. Take a look at it. It's a good article. And at 7 p.m., Amy talks. You can purchase your tickets by going to our website, which is www.carboroughradio.com, carboroughradio.com, or you can email tmhartman@nc.rr.com, or call 919-619-6546. Again, this is sponsored by WCOM, WNCU, the People's Channel, and Balance and Accuracy in Journalism. And Amy Goodman is coming here to help to talk to us about her latest book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. And now we're back with our guest, Linda Marie Taurasi, talking about the journey of reconciliation.
Hello.
In Chapel Hill. Hi. One thing we want to mention here is that Reverend Charles Jones.
That's it. Sorry, yes. Jim Peck was one of the writers.
Yeah.
It's a lot different when you're trying to go from memory as opposed to having your notes in front of
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Oh, I sympathize. So Reverend Jones, who was a white Presbyterian minister, who was, by the way, expelled from the church, and he helped found the Community Church of Chapel Hill, which is still going and still a bastion of progressive, compassionate activism. So tell us a little bit about his part in this.
Well, they came to Chapel Hill to visit the Reverend Jones, and Jim Peck, who I said was the Reverend, was actually one of the travelers, and so he was among that group. And they stopped on April 12th to have a nice visit, and they went to a party and met with a bunch of other congressioners and congregates, rather, and the next day they boarded the bus. Well, they were arrested. Four men were arrested. And then there was a group of white cab drivers who witnessed the arrest, and they were harassing them.
And Reverend Jones's life was threatened, wasn't it? They threatened to burn his house down.
Well, what happened was they called the Reverend Jones to come pick him up, and so he did after they were bailed out, and they went back to his house. Well, the white cab drivers followed him, and then they had, like, sticks and stones, and they were on his lawn harassing him. And so they decided, the Reverend Jones took his whole family, drove them into Greensboro, Durham, to get to Greensboro, and then he left his house for 2 weeks, him and his family.
Yeah. Oh, wow, because he'd gotten a phone call saying, yeah, you'll burn your house down tonight.
I think it was a phone call. Yeah.
So, but anyway, tell me a little bit about it. Maybe Lucy knows something too about the why it took so long for this to be. You don't hear a lot about it in Chattanooga.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I certainly didn't know about it until I had to cover the event for WCHL. And then I was fascinated by the story and fell in love with it. I mean, you certainly never hear of Bayard Rustin unless you're in the circle, unless you're in, like, the progressive movement circle, or you're in, you know, nonviolence organizing and means of protest. But if you're just an average citizen, even in, you know, I'm North Carolina educated in the public system, and I'd never heard about this.
Really? Never heard
about
it?
Yeah, never, ever, ever heard about it. And certainly didn't know that Bayard Rustin mentored Martin Luther King Jr. on nonviolence. That was definitely something.
Well, I had heard his name. I actually met one of the writers back in the late 60s or 70s on a bus when I was traveling across country.
Wow.
And so we sat, in fact, in the back of the bus just traveling. I was just a kid traveling, and he told me some of the story, and that's how I think I first heard the name.
Do you remember Bayard who it Rustin. Was?
Yes, I his name was Hosea. I can't remember his last name, but it was Hosea, and I remember him. And the Lucy has just handed me a note asking me what happened after the arrests. The time served. That was a
right. That's interesting. Four men were the NAACP did not want to take the case, which is really interesting because they took Irene Morgan's case. But George Hauser said it was because they handed the bus tickets over to the lawyers at the NAACP, and they were somehow lost.
That's right.
So they couldn't.
They lost the evidence.
Yeah, they lost the evidence. Okay. So. A judge in Hillsboro sentenced Bayard Rustin and another man whose name is escaping me to 30 days on the chain gang. And through that time, Bayard Rustin chronicled his experience called 22 days on a chain gang that was serialized by then the New York Post, which if you think about it now, and the New York Post is a complete tabloid rag, you know, that they would even have this, like, great journalistic piece. And he serialized it, and it was an expose on the state prison conditions in North Carolina and how they were treated. A lot of the times the men were shackled by their hands.
And they were strung up.
They were strung up by their hands for hours and hours upon time. Their food was spoiled. They weren't being hydrated enough as they were working on the chain gang. And Bayard Rustin wrote all of this down. And then it caused the North Carolina state prison system to end the chain gangs in 1949. So, I mean, it was just a fascinating piece of history that is just somehow overlooked, you know.
It is. It really is. And the two of the white men received even longer sentences, did they not? Because the judge wanted to show them that they could not force civil rights on the South.
Right.
He wanted to make an example of them so that to keep other whites from becoming involved.
And even called them, like, Northern Jews. It was something degrading and belittling in court. Yeah. But that was, you know, 40s. I mean, Hillsboro certainly now is much more conservative than Chapel Hill is. And that's just, I guess, a mark of the times. So it was really sad. But anyway, so our local chapter of the NAACP wanted to highlight this and have the state marker. And so they held an event at Hargraves Community Center to reenact the bus route and what happened on the bus, and George Hauser was there. And I don't know if you've ever seen George Hauser.
He's old now.
He's 92, but he looks great. He looks like he's in his 60s. Like, I guess I didn't do the math in my head, but I was like, this man's 92 years old. Yeah. And, like, he is so vibrant, and he has an impeccable memory, like, can cite every single detail of what happened. He was telling me how he met his wife, and he courted his wife while he was in prison, and...
Bayard Rustin lived to be quite old, too, didn't he? He died in the
70s, and he was in his 70s, I think. And there's some kind of controversy about Bayard Rustin, too. He was a black Quaker, which is why he was into nonviolence. And
he was also a gay man.
He was a gay man, and he was actually shunned by the Fellowship of Reconciliation for a number of years.
That's what. I knew there was something in there that I was trying to figure out. What was it that's
yeah.
what it was?
Now they love him, you know, but at the time they... You know, and George Hauser said, I knew he was a gay man. He was openly gay. He was, to be black in 1940s and then to be a gay black man, I mean, and then to be proud of it and to be open about it and to be an activist and put yourself on the line like that. I mean, just an amazing story.
It is an amazing story.
And you never hear about him mentoring Martin Luther King Jr. That blew my mind.
No, I wish we had more time for that. We're going to have to wrap up. But he did, what I was reading, that he did persuade Dr. King that nonviolence and peace had to be key to this movement if it was going to succeed in a productive way.
And that's because while they were at the Congress of Racial Equality, both George Hauser and Bayard Rustin worked for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which charged CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and they were studying Gandhi, and they were studying how the nonviolent movement, peace movement, worked in India, and that's what inspired them.
And that's what they wanted to bring that to the United States, to the civil rights movement. So basically, this journey showed us nonviolence could do, nonviolent resistance and action could do. And
it's just ironic that it turned violent in Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't turn, at least it didn't turn bloody, thank God. But it did, you're right, there's too much embedded racism still.
But that was their biggest incident on this journey, was Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which, you know, they were surprised. They kind of looked at Chapel Hill as a haven.
Yeah. Was a good. Well, thank you, Linda Murray.
No problem.
And good luck with getting the rest of the story edited.
But it'll air at 6:30 on April 9th. Free Speech Radio News.
April 9th. Okay. Oh, on the day of that. Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So April 9th, 2009, you're going to learn about something that happened April 9th in 1947.
Yeah.
So... thank you for joining us. You have been listening to the Wilf Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Tana Hartman. Our engineer is Dick Paddock, and co-host Lucy Lewis. And our guest has been Linda Marie Taurasi. Don't forget about Amy Goodman, April 8th. And you are listening to WCOMLP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Stay tuned for Amy Goodman, and we'll see you next Wednesday. Bye.